utopia. There's this horror utopia, right? Horrortopia is what she wants to create. Or I guess retired. And he seems
the
to
horn
be
of plenty. The horn utopia. The horn utopia. Okay, enough. No. Enough sex worker jokes. These are all outdated, hateful terms.
Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun on Hulu. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 7, A Stick of Time. Aaron, they make a pretty overt reference in this episode. We don't really need to discuss what that title means. You know, it's just a moment. And there are a lot of moments in this episode. What'd you think of it?
I'm going to start timing all my meetings with incense stick. You got this till this burns down to the sand, fucker, and then you're getting out of here. What an episode. This was a roller coaster ride. Like, I'm watching this for the first time. I don't know what the fuck's going to happen. And, like, there's a point, like, 30 minutes in where I'm like, oh, my God, am I watching Shogun's Red Wedding? And then I'm like, am I watching Shogun's Red Wedding? And at the end, I'm like, okay, well, if this is the Red Wedding, did the Starks win? Did the Lannisters win? Like, what the fuck is going on?
Sure.
And on subsequent rewatches, I've kind of come to some ideas of my own of what I think is happening, but another showstopper episode with all-time gut punch at the end. Incredible and so atmospheric. Just how shrouded with mist this is from the long ago opening to the very end. It continues to be incredible. I love the show. How'd you find it?
Yeah, I'm with you. They haven't really missed with an episode yet, in my opinion. I think this is another solid episode. The Red Wedding like nature of it, I think, is welcome. I was kind of like half expecting it, but they lulled me sort of into a. Just an okay place before they sort of turned the tables, and that was very good. The other like big thing I noticed about this episode is until now, I think you could be forgiven for sort of like becoming entranced by the beauty and the exoticism and the ritual of concerning death and how they face death in that society. And this is kind of a rebuke of that. This is the exact opposite. This is the ugly part of death. This is, if you were entranced by that, you need to break out of that trance right now and see that people stab each other in the back. That honor stuff only goes so far, and it might even just be a veneer over the real stuff that's happening here. And then it's a rebuke of the idea of war being glorious, right? This is like, this could be a Klingon episode in Star Trek as well, where Worf just wants to go off to war or something, and then he gets a taste of it, and it's like, oh no, war, that's actually horrible. No one should want that. That's what this episode is doing. It's telling us all that stuff you were feeling before, maybe recontextualize it a little bit, because you probably bought into it a little too much.
And you wonder, like, how Nagakato would feel about rushing headlong into battle if he wasn't trying to live up to his father's reputation, which is not entirely accurate. I mean, don't get me wrong, super fucking impressive to win a battle when you're 12 years old. But, wanting to get the enemy's head off in one clean blow, I wonder, like, if Nagakato doesn't slip on his uncle's silk kimono, if he's not so worried about living up to that reputation.
Yeah, it's possible.
And like, that's the other thing is I have some feelings about it, but I really do not know exactly what Toranaga's plans are.
I'm with you, man. It's hard to see a path forward for him.
In fact, I almost wonder at the wisdom of the scene where there's a character, the Lady Gin essentially turns directly to the camera, winks, and says, "Don't give up hope, folks. Toranaga's got this." I like that for like all the things that it does, but it also has me really questioning the end of the episode. I think you can make an argument that maybe I'm pretty sure what's happening is Toranaga's kid Tornada's kid is going off half-cocked and doing something rash.
Of course, that's his MO.
But also with his meeting with the Lady Gin and the scratching ear back, it's like, was this strike maybe authorized or sanctioned? Or
well, my guess as to what happened there is that Toranaga does have something going on. He's making a play here, but his kid doesn't know that, and he just does what his kid does and goes off half cock, like you said.
I think you're right. I got I definitely have some things to unpack when we talk about those scenes. But yeah, just another incredible episode. It's amazing how Blackthorn has become a background character in the last episode or two. Mm-hmm. You know, he almost feels like he's like some kind of omniscient narrator where he just comes in and pronounces judgment on what we've just seen. Like,
And I'm still waiting for kind of the other shoe to drop on that. I'm a lot like Blackthorn here. I'm just waiting to find out my fate, that particular plotline's fate, because I don't know where he factors into this. Toranaga wants to keep him around. Why?
Ah, but fate's only useful for those who know how to wield it, so.
Sure.
There's also a lot of, there's a couple of lines in this episode that, like, did as much for me as, like, a month of talk therapy. Like, Fuji's, you simple, we do what we can when we can, and we hope that it's enough. Like, God damn, sister, same. That's been my mantra for a couple years now.
You have nowhere left to go and nothing left to be. That's the one that resonated with me.
That is a hard line. Kidding,
but that's
nothing left to be. You're still alive, but you've nothing left to be. Wow.
Man, wow. I dream of those days. It's called retirement, right?
I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't say my retirement would be nothing left to be. Jesus Christ.
Oh, mine's going to be,
are we, just providers? Is that all the worth we have in society as soon as we're done?
Oh, yeah.
Being productive, we're like those old prostitutes.
Yep.
You know, gave our youth and our wit and our charm for these great men, and then just die. Die. Have a heart attack, preferably before 65. So
is
you don't
that not how it is? Is that convince me that that's not what our society is set up to do?
Well, it's not how we say it is.
Okay.
We have our own.
That's a distinction.
We have our own eightfold fences in this society.
Totally.
Link type affairs, but you know.
What do you think? You want to start talking about the episode proper?
Yeah, let's do it. As we mentioned in our opening, we see a baby Toranaga on the field of battle where he has won a great victory and he accepts personally the surrender of the warlord opposite of him.
Yeah, he's like 12 years old here.
I remember when I was watching this episode, you know, you hear it's like, you know, Lord Toranaga, and I'm like, oh, this must be his first battle. And I'm like, I wonder how young he is. And as I was thinking that, it says 46 years ago. And I'm like, holy shit. And I start doing math in my head. I'm like, what is, like, Toranaga 77? And then when you see him, it's like very much the silhouette of Toranaga, you know, like this great man on the horse. And he turns his face like, holy shit, he's just a kid. And you find out later he was 12 years old.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you were doing when you were 12?
I think I did the Apollo 13 marathon one day while I was sick.
I was trying to figure out if I was too old to play with Transformers and Legos. Like, I was thinking, you know, am I going to get bitches with this? Like, do I need to start listening to like adult music now? And this guy's fucking winning wars.
Yeah. No, it's, and beheading people. It's messed up.
It's just amazing because that's the other thing when I read these old wooden ship boats that I'm, or books, old wooden ship books that I'm fond of. I'm always amazed at seeing, like, you know, midshipmen who are like 9 and 10 years old leading cannon divisions and boarding parties.
Yeah,
and I'm
crazy.
Just like, that's just people built different. I guess you get thrown into the mines and factories when you're 5 or 6. Yeah. you acquire experience fast, but clearly an exceptional guy.
Yeah, I don't know about you, and maybe it's hard to tell with all the armor and stuff that he's wearing, this big helmet and stuff, but I didn't think that kid looked particularly like Toranaga. didn't think the casting was amazing there.
Oh, geez. No, I mean,
it's like the one complaint
I didn't even have. It didn't even come to mind. Yeah. Although I will say that I thought it wasn't until second watch that I realized Ihiro Matsu, the Iron Fist, was the guy who was kind of his second.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, that he's kind of looking back to, like, what should I do here? Which kind of shows an insight into their relationship. But yeah, I didn't notice that he was poorly cast. I don't know.
Yeah. I really like where they cut this scene, too. It's as the blade comes down on this guy. Because the other warlord who has lost the battle is, like, expected to and does commit seppuku. And, you know, they have the second, which is a guy that stands behind you with the sword ready to chop your head off so you don't have to suffer too long. Toranaga is going to be that. And so he slices down, and you're assuming, because it cuts away at that moment, that it just succeeded, right? And you kind of carry that assumption through most of the episode. And so when it's revealed that that's not at all how it went down, I think it really serves that, you know, sort of, I guess, false impression that we've been getting over the course of this entire season, this entire series, about the beautiful and glorious death, the stuff that Nagakato is going to talk about throughout this episode. It really, like, punctuated that in a way, because I had assumed it was just a single blow and boom, it was over.
Yeah, I agree. That's what they're selling. Like, he has a smooth stroke and a cut to black, and it's like, well, of course, he just won the battle. He's going to beat this guy. And it also is another thing of kind of like what you're talking about in the intro about the beautiful death versus the reality. Like, here's this guy as he's about to die, fantasizing about it. Maybe in the afterlife, I'll be able to get one over on you, Toranaga. And now his guts are spilled out, and this boy is hacking his head off it's a rusty axe in a tough tree. And, you know, you compare that to, like, what, Saiki, his brother, says about, you know, death is just a lonely path through dark woods. You know, there's nothing glamorous
about
it.
Doesn't seem like he believes in the afterlife.
Yeah, or if he does, I mean, I think that's like but it's a bleak showing. It's not you know, I'm going to some glorious thing.
I'm not going to meet all my loved ones there or anything.
This episode is all about contrasting the very romantic view of death that we've been served versus the realities.
Yeah, totally.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move. So yeah, we then, after the intro, we see Toranaga waiting at the head of his host for the arrival of his brother's army. And we find out that much depends on his brother's willingness to ally with him.
The first thing that occurred to me is we just kind of skipped right over the Buntaro isolation from Mariko phase of that relationship. And I was kind of eager to see him stew a little bit in that. We get more of that this episode for sure. But yeah, we just jump right past it. That was weird.
The question I had, Jim, is do you think that the week has actually expired? Or are we supposed to understand that like maybe Omi stirred to shit so much that Buntaro has to kind of break?
No, I think the timing of like Seki showing up, like because they got to get a message to him and he's got to get from Osaka to a Jiro or whatever the city they're in is. So it's been a while.
Yeah, I just don't know because it seems like they can send messages pretty quick, especially by pigeon. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously, writing an army takes longer. But I don't know. You're right because we had a similar like wasn't Blackthorn like supposed to be training the guys for 6 months and why Lord Tornaga got his. But I that's the other thing is done. I never understood is like did Lord Tornaga come back early or. Did it really take 6 months? And that's how long it took to muster the troops? And you know, how long have the regents been sidelined? So I'm a little loosey-goosey on the time, but it never feels like it's... The only reason I ask is because I always noticed that Buntaro was away from his wife, and he was always, like, coming by, like, an inside passing, tell the barbarian to keep his mouth fucking shut. Uh-huh. Or, you know, it's like he wasn't with her, and, you know... So, but again, Mariko's duties seem like to take her away from him a lot anyway. She's by Toranaga's side more than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But he Lando Calrissian's his brother here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
you old piss drinking bat. You know, you got a lot of nerve and they set it up so beautifully because like the Iron Fist is nervous and I've never seen him nervous about anything. And Yabushiga's like, yeah, when's the last time they talk? It's too, the only spot's too long.
Mm-hmm.
And when his brother does that remark about like, oh, I see your decimated army. So in your desperation, you call on your unaccomplished brother with his vast host. And like you can see the Iron Fist do the thing where he pops his sword like, oh, shit, it's about to go down. Mm-hmm. And then he pulls the full Lando and really the full Lando. It's
beat for beat.
Yeah. Yeah. You piss drinking bastard.
And that's the thing, I'm looking at this and I'm saying his brother seems so good natured. He's way looser than Toranaga. Toranaga is this buttoned up guy who doesn't even want to show his first heart, let alone his third. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this guy who seems to be jovial and full of spirit. He's almost like a Yabushige kind of guy, right? In his spirit.
Uh-huh.
These guys couldn't be more different in my mind. And so I'm like, this guy, he's really charming me, but should he trust it? Should he trust that guy?
So you're Laying the whole time.
Yeah. And I think by the time...
Saiki seems like a great guy. Yeah. Mm.
By the time we get to the part where they reveal his true nature, I had kind of been lulled into a false sense of liking this guy.
Yeah.
And it all starts here. I mean, he's very charming here. I really enjoyed this scene.
Plus, he looks incredible. Like, I don't know about the tall hat, but everything
Korean
else about
show?
This outfit.
That zombie show that we watched.
The zombie
the
show.
Season.
Was it Kingdom?
I don't
even
think that's come back. Kingdom, yes. That had an impeccable hat game. This guy would have fit right in there. This hat.
I wonder if the Korean... Because, like, I've noticed that, like, most of the hat... game because I compared it to Kingdom when I first but I'm like it's just not quite like Kingdom is full-on Final Fantasy Tactics shit like every single thing that someone wore was like something that gave +3 to Magicka. I feel like I wonder if Korea led the way in fashion, like, you know, the Japanese and Chinese are like, we gotta fucking keep up with these guys in their hat game.
That's the thing, they went over
anything.
Tried to invade Korea and the one
must.
Thing that they got from that was the hat.
Is there they were able to get the Koreans third best hats and like, yo, this is really, you know, we were just shaving our head and doing weird ponytails and now
oh, I mean the Korean hair game is nothing like the Japanese hair game, but the hat
true.
game,
it's a real rock paper scissors type of thing.
Yeah, you should see the loincloth game of the Chinese.
Wow. Because these string loincloths that Yabashika was rocking pretty hot.
Trust me, you think that's impressive.
I try to do, because I always love when they do untranslated proper nouns. And his brother mentions, you know, about how good, or Tornaga says, you look really good. And he does. He looks noticeably less worn. And he goes, well, if you had to guard the still waters of the Yuzinji, you'd look as good, too. I could not find anything about that, like whether that's a river or a bay or whatever. But apparently he's in a backwater. You know, he's.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like a hot spring kind of thing where like he just gets to bathe in the hot springs all day.
maybe.
But also the backwater thing, like you said, he doesn't see much action.
You mentioned that his about how different he is than Toranaga, but like by the end of the episode, especially in subsequent watches, I wonder if he, yeah, if this big gregarious thing is his false heart.
Yeah.
You know, like Toranaga does this thing where he's just completely stoic. He has this smooth exterior that's impenetrable. Saiki. He puts this as like a, he just wears a mask because like, man, that point during the quote unquote red wedding scene where after he tells that story about Toranaga shitting his pants and like the way his face changes and like sets in stone. It's like, you can see that as Toranaga's half brother in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Once he reveals his true nature for sure.
Yeah. I also love how like all they have these scenes, just great, just reaction scenes of all Toranaga's men just kind of visibly or subtly relaxing. It's like, you know, it's like once they say, oh, thank God. And they're, you know, kind of put their swords back and sigh with relief. Moving on to the next scene, we see Blackthorn ask for an audience with the Lord Toranaga. And he asks once again, what the hell does being an admiral of your fleet mean anyway, old man? Toranaga is unmoved.
Yeah, boy, I'm with JB here. I want to know. What are your plans for me, man? I'm here. I taught you how to use the cannons. You won't let me actually use the cannons. I don't know what my purpose is here anymore, and yet you won't let me leave either. So
I've got this ship of superior capabilities that you seem completely uninterested in using, and yet I'm an admiral. I saw a lot of debate in our Discord and in other places about like how much of Toranaga's plan that he shares with Blackthorn, if he has a plan. I guess we're assuming that.
Sure.
What's your reading by the end of this episode? Because I think Blackthorn is being told nothing.
And same here.
If anything, the way everyone's emphasizing about shut the fuck up, don't say anything, shut the fuck up. Like, so he's told that many times. Like, I almost wonder if his outburst at the end is a calculated thing that Toranaga, it's like, I'm going to set, you know, I'm going to wind up the Anjin in a particular way. So he'll, because like everything that happens is kind of selling his helplessness. Like even his barbarian advisor, who's got the magic weapon that he made sure it's like, oh, it's our key to our plans. He's disaffected and wants to walk out of the camp. But I don't think Blackthorn's playing the part. I think he's just being kind of played like a secondhand fiddle by Toranaga.
Yeah, you could be right. I mean, the fact that he's his Hatamoto is I think a big deal when he stands up and curses them and he says you're all dead and walks out. It should be a big deal to everyone there, right? That's symbolically devastating to Toranaga. And yeah, if that's part of his plan, I suppose he wants to look very weak here in a moment where maybe he isn't. I can't really see it, but that could possibly be where we're going. I think he does need to remember that he's essentially a prisoner here. He is not a peer of Toranaga, whether he's Hatamoto or not. I don't think he understands that he doesn't have the ability to request anything here. he seems to think that his force of will can just sort of steamroll, I don't know, his situation and get him out of this and get his ship back and he can head back to England or I don't know, Netherlands, wherever he is going to port up. But he needs to remember he's basically a prisoner here, even if he is a Hatamoto.
You're right, but like the thing is he is being, he's been rewarded almost every time he does something crazy.
Yeah, and it's super like, confusing. I get it. Like he's understandably frustrated.
So that's you can almost see it's like, well, Mariko's telling me to like chill, but like my lack of chill is what's kept me alive and got me in this position. So you can kind of see him like, okay, I'm going to ignore what you say because, but yeah, this time it feels different. Like Torunaga's like, just, yeah, shut the fuck up, get in line.
And by the end, like him walking out, I mean, that's just him giving up on Torunaga. Like, I'm just going to make feels my own like way. It. You guys feels are all like dead it. Anyway. I'm out of here.
Right. So we again have a brief scene of Omi requesting a night of, or maybe just a meeting with Kuki, the prize
Kuki.
Courtesan.
Kiku.
Yeah. God damn it. I started so notes. I've started to blend Torunaga's name with his son. I'm doing a lot of Torakato and thing. I'm sorry.
And Fuji my brain, and Kiku. Yeah.
My brain and syllables are like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree. I'm trying my best. I'm really fighting for my life on these recaps.
It's not easy.
But he is denied by Lady Gin. Says not, I could find. I could find a courtesan more suitable to your station, which is just a kick in the nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what? He's the nephew of one of the vassals of Torunaga. I mean, he's nobody here, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is interesting to me because it's not just that, you know, Omi is getting put in his place here, but she mentions something that seems to be custom made to undermine Torunaga. She says, yeah. she hints that Mariko might have eyes for Blackthorn. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why she would drop this information, especially with what we see later from Gin. There is some like triple fold plan here that I don't quite see the resolution of yet.
What also flies in the face of what she says is so important to a profession, which is discretion.
Yes.
It's like, oh, everything that happens in the willow world, it's like all the tree branches shield and it's all a mystery. Oh, by the way,
right?
Mariko won the raw dog Blackthorn and didn't have anything to do with like
it seems
that,
like this tea
what?
House is working directly against Torunaga in that moment, because that's going to sow dissent in his ranks. That's not what you need at the moment, at the cusp of war,
and degrade the reputation of the tea house. So like this, the text is screaming there's something subtextual going on here. Because everything that Lady Gin is doing is for effect in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
So
seems like it.
If but I could be wrong. She could be playing. I don't think either of us are wrong. It's just we don't really know to what end things are worked out. Who's doing things on their own? Who's doing things because of Torunaga? What things people are doing that Torunaga's maybe hoping or expecting to happen? Because that was a debate we had with the whole canon incident with Jozen, right?
Sure.
Like the Nagakato. Obviously, he didn't have his father's permission to do that, but was in that one of the sets of things that Torunaga is hoping would happen
Possibly. Had
game planned out to happen. It's tough with a schemer and a plotter, especially one that we don't get any idea of his interior. Like this story is being told completely outside his eightfold gates. Which is interesting, but at some point, that's when a lot of people are debating about, you know, whether Blackthorn knew about the plan or not. And I don't know. Do you think I'm out of line for saying this? But I'll actually be a little bit let down if it turns out that Blackthorn was in on it, because I accept that Torunaga is a deep old file and he's going to keep things as a secret from us, the audience, and his people.
Mm-hmm.
Blackthorn is us. Blackthorn is the audience. If he's being brought in on the confidence on a plan that he knows of and we don't, that's a huge violation of what the storytelling they're doing. And I'm not saying you can't do it, but to me, they would have to really finesse that for me not to be like, well, that's horseshit, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. Narratively, that doesn't feel right. Also, from a character perspective, Torunaga should not have this enough trust in Blackthorn to bring him in on a plan that is life or death for not just him, but everyone under him for all of his friends. Right. That might blurt things out. He's an outsider. He could fuck up a custom accidentally and cause a war. Like, you can't bring this guy into your confidence. If anybody's in his confidence, it's Hiramatsu. It's perhaps Mariko. Those are really like the Buntaro, maybe he's like an outside guess here, but like those are the real people who might be in on this. Not even his son. That's the thing. Like, I think he trusts that Blackthorn is competent, at least. He's not a complete idiot, but he's also very ignorant and naive. And that kind of likens him to his son in that way. Like, his Nagakato isn't brought in on Torunaga's plans because he can't handle the plans. He's too immature. He's too green. He's too gung-ho. His head isn't in the right place. And I feel like the Anjin is a lot like that.
Yeah. I'm also always interpreting this stuff, too, in terms of the Falcon image, you know, motifs that, like...
He's fondling a Falcon in this episode.
All the time. And it's like, I'm always thinking of, like, you know, he might not have control over, like, Blackthorn or his son, Nagakato, but he knows what type of Falcons they are, and he knows how to break them, and he knows how to use them, or at least how to keep them from doing damage. So it's like, anything that happens, I kind of, and maybe I'm giving him way too much powers of observation and estimation, but like, I feel like anything that happens is something that's within the realm of possibility that he's considered.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So we have another scene of the Iron Fist Hiramatsu visiting his favorite granddaughter Fuji to bring her gifts.
Might not be his favorite granddaughter anymore. There's a moment in this, so she's grateful that he brought her the ashes of her family. But then she mentions, let's say she audibly doubts their victory in this war. Mm. And that, I don't even think Hiramatsu has considered that possibility. The way he reacts here, I don't know if it's that he just legitimately never thought they would lose, or if it's that, oh no, my granddaughter here doesn't even believe in this cause. We're totally screwed. I can't tell which it is, but the look on his face when she says what she says about it, you know, meeting them soon in the afterlife or whatever, it made me think that he was really taken aback by that.
My reading is that it's one of those things where he had his private doubts, like, you know, Torunaga's never lost a battle.
Yeah.
But like, goddamn, things look bad. I don't know about this brother. And his granddaughter, who he said is his favorite, his the best one, the smartest, most insightful, like her expressing the same private doubt. I think it's like, have you ever had an experience where you're kind of having like some, you know, doubts about and someone you respect, or, you know, a coworker that you're like, is this company going down the drain? And like, you're in a bar and they say the first thing, and then suddenly it's like real. It was just in your head. And now I think it's kind of one of those things where he's having this moment of like, and also maybe just sorrow of like, geez, this woman's had such a hard life and we've denied her for this, you know, blah, blah, this honor for this great victory. And like, what if it never comes? Like, you know, as an old man, you got to have thoughts about the futility of things.
Yeah.
Like a life of heroism and honor and service, and it's going to come down to kneeling in front of a bunch of bureaucrats and while you're being gutted, like, ugh.
Yeah.
It's also, the thing is like this scene, like, I'm starting to have like this parasocial relationship with this show. Like, I do this a lot of historical thing, like Downton Abbey. You know, it's like sometimes I get a thrill of pleasure when two characters I've never seen interact. He's like, oh, my God, you don't usually see Lady Mary and Carson get the moment alone. And it's sweet and it's nice. And like, well, as soon as he's like, Fuji, I'm like, oh, this is his favorite granddaughter. And I love Fuji. I love the Iron Fist. This is going to be. And then like slowly it curdles as you see. Just depressing and sad. But like, there was like 30 to 60 seconds of genuine happiness of him just taking pleasure in seeing what a fine woman his granddaughter is, and her being happy that her grandpa has come out of nowhere to visit her.
This scene is like a microcosm of the episode in that way. Like, you see all this excitement and this, you know, affection, and then it just curdles.
So Torunaga's brother, Saiki, bathes in the hot springs while preparations are made for his grand feast. That night, the men all drink and dine together, telling stories of their youth before things take a dark turn.
Yeah, I really like this guy's style. From his hair to his robe. His robe, man. Like white robe he's wearing. I'd say he outdoes Torunaga in this scene. Yeah.
And he's got the frame. He's got that lanky frame that can pull it off too, but it's just, yeah, it looks good on him. He's the swagger. It's a swagger that he's got.
Yeah. That helps for sure.
They're very early establishing Nagakato as being, like you mentioned, this gung-ho guy, and you know, he's as the apparent battle gets closer and closer, he's just getting more and more about it. And he's like, Is it true that a man's first kill in a battlefield is better than his first pillowing? Because he's never had both, apparently. Mm-hmm. And Buntero is like just openly dismissive. Like, where the fuck did you get that? And Yabu, God love him, is like, it depends on the woman.
Yeah, of course. Of course, that'd be his first thing.
Yeah.
And you see Omi taking this piece of information that he got from the tea house and running with it.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of sowing this seed with Buntaro now, right? He's like, oh, it must be an honor seeing your wife perform her duty with the Anjin, with the Hatamoto, right? Dude.
I'm surprised he's got the balls to do this, because Buntaro's right? So in the red line with his engine that, like, Omi, even as polite and as
complimentary. Just pissed off. Yeah, he's pissed off because Torunaga has booked up all of his favorite courtesan's time. He's like feeling butthurt about that, and it's
right after he did the barbarian disgraced the whole place with his stink. No,
he sees himself losing status, and he's just here stirring up shit. That's what he's doing.
And especially you see Buntaro looking across the way at Mariko with the barbarian. And I will say that they were being nothing but, like, there is no sparks flying in this scene.
No.
But, like, you see, like, Blackthorn spilling food on his kimono, and, like, he's, like, he can't use his chopsticks, so he's dropping food. And, like, Buntaro is just, like, just seething the entire time about what a filthy
this
fucking
brute.
Yeah, he's making eyes at my wife that... Yeah. Wants to die rather than pillow with me.
And this is where the scene gets really good.
But Omi gets it right back, because right as he just put the spurs, the Buntaro, Iron Fist, I don't know if it's because he overhears it, but Iron Fist is like, hey, tell us about the gift that Lord T gave to you. He's that. And that's Ami's one he's talking about. And then he kind of dismisses her, like, beauty, so fleeting. It's like, trying to fuck a sunset, and Omi's like, but you do get to fuck a sunset. Yes, the sunset does not last, but you do get to fuck it.
And then he launches into, you know, the stories, and the story time is where it really gets interesting for me. The way that the stories are telling a story here in this scene, he starts out with a fun story, right? It's not fun, but it's an honorable story. About him beheading the warlord, right? And he says, he was 12 years old and the head came off in one blow. And he's honoring Torunaga in this first story. And then the way that this vibe just changes over the course of several stories, and the way that Seki brings it back, because the conversation has kind of moved on. And then he's like, I got one more story for you. Here's the one about him shitting his pants. And it's so disrespectful. And you're just like, oh, no, he wouldn't. There are two reasons he would tell this story. One, because he's blind drunk. And he seems a little drunk, but not that drunk. The other is if he's trying intentionally to disrespect his brother.
I think there's another possibility. And also, you left out the best part where he set up this bump set spike. His initial maneuver was to be muse aloud. What if I demanded payment, the very province of your most hot-headed, treacherous samurai? And Yabushiga is like, that's his turn to see. I swear to God, this is just a table of, like, cucks circling each other all the way around. Like, everybody's just trying to, like, you know, emasculate each other.
And I thought he was doing this to have him negotiate in front of everyone where he would necessarily be more generous, right?
Yeah.
I thought he was trying to eke out a little bit more from this deal, but it turns out he's just about to totally switch sides.
Yeah, and he just, it's just like from that on, there's like this, there's this particular fine performance where he finishes the, you know, oh, your dad shit his pants story, and then wrote, I looked this up, I guess a re is about 4 kilometers or 2.5 miles. So, you know, Toranaga rode 25 miles in America for with shitty pants. But, like, you know, there's a moment at the end where, like, he kind of, like, looks at, because, you know, he's telling a story with the same jocularity he was the previous, where all the samurai were laughing, and, you know, when the brothers are going back about who had more women and all that stuff, everybody's having a good time. But now everybody's silent because I know their lord's being insulted. And there's this look on his face where you're like, oh, maybe he did have too much to drink. But then his face just, like, over the course of 5 to 10 seconds just sets into stone. And he's like, you know, which do you prefer, Nagakado, the legend or the fact? The me being the Lord of Izo, that's a hell of a legend, but unfortunately I've been given another offer. And that's when the men outside start screaming, the whole tone changes. He gives an execution order to his son. He serves tea with the notice. But do you, so it's like, I guess we should talk, you know, there's two schools of thought. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's kind of, it seems like there's two schools of thought that either Saiki is there to betray his brother and Toranaga has a plan to get out of it, or this is something they've worked out together and they're going to go to Osaka in unison and then execute Order Crimson Sky. Now, if you buy that theory, maybe some of this is trying to tell Nagakado to cool his jets, because this is a warning about, you know, not just, like the legends versus the myths versus the actual cold reality. And he tries to say this to his nephew a couple of times, just never will hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his father's been telling him that too constantly. Yeah, that's an interesting possibility that Saiki and him are actually still in league, even though it appears that they're in opposition.
And this is where we find that Saiki also has become the fifth regent after Sugiyama got killed by Shido's treachery. So he, but I do wonder, like, what has he been promised? Was he promised Izu? Like, that's a nice province, but, like, I don't think Yabushiga is, like, high rolling amongst the samurais. I wonder, again, if Toranaga does pull off the win, he could, you know, he could give up any of the four regions for Terra. He'd own all of Japan. He could give his brother whatever the hell he wanted to.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be Yabu, because Yabu is, you know, he's kind of working for himself here. He's not really on Toranaga's side. But if he becomes a useful instrument, like, you wouldn't want to take away his lands from him.
Well, and he's already been promised another province on top of Izu. So, yeah. Which of those possibilities do you favor? Do you think that Saiki is working for the regents? Do you think he's a double agent? Do you think that this is something Toranaga and him have worked out in advance?
I don't know, because, man, if this is cover, it's deep cover, because he hasn't even brought, I don't think he's even brought Hiramatsu on board with this one. And Hiro's usually the guy who's in on the plan. If anybody's going to be in on it, it's him. And the way that Hiramatsu is interacting with the other people in this village, it feels like he's not in on the plan. But that, you know, that could be because he doesn't want to let them on the plan. I don't know. I'm a little dubious on that, but it would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does he get his army? I mean, so he has another army somewhere, his Edo army, or no?
That's one of the base. Because, again, I haven't read the books. I haven't even really familiar with the history. But I do know that Bentaro offers to ride out to summon their troops in Edo.
Yeah.
So that tells me that there must be some provincial army that, you probably wouldn't call in peacetime because they're probably there to defend the territory, but like in an all like that he's got another army he could call on.
Because I'm thinking he can't use this army, right? I mean, this army isn't coming with him. I guess he could leave Hera behind and say, hey, follow us in, because once we get inside the gates, we're going to launch our attack and just be right behind us to come in.
See, my impression is the whole army would come with him because a lot of them are going to die. Or be reapportioned to other... Yeah, because I mean, she mentioned half of his followers will, but I don't know if she's talking about his inner, like his knights.
I think he's talking about his lords, his vassal lords, not necessarily the just enlisted guys or whatever you would call
for
them.
For whatever reason, I thought they would be, so that's like, because that was the kind of like, okay, well, if they're in secret alliance and they march up to the gates of Asaku with both armies and then they combine at the end and take... you know, Shido and Osaka by surprise, but it's, I don't know. It's,
he says something later when he's surrendering that Crimson Sky was a mistake. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say admitting that Crimson Sky is a mistake doesn't mean you don't have another plan.
Yeah.
It could just mean that was the wrong move and I've got something better.
All right. I've got some other ideas to float past you here.
Well, I want to talk about that, the order that comes down for Nagakato to commit seppuku.
Sure.
And the way that Toranaga firmly rejects that, right? Nagakato is about to reach out and take this piece of paper, which would essentially, you know, it's like taking delivery of a summons or something, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. to court. Yeah. Now it's official. You've been summoned.
Served.
Right. If he doesn't touch this piece of paper here, maybe the order isn't official yet. And he's looking at his son like, you're just going to accept this, you know, like, don't touch that thing. Don't accept this. We're going to come up with a plan and I'm going to buy us a day to do it.
Yeah.
And whether he does or not is debatable.
That like, yeah, that like, it's one of those formalistic legalistic things. That's like, as long as you don't touch and actually read it,
right,
order hasn't been, you could say that I haven't actually seen the order, it's a hearsay, but you know, there's sure. a lot of that about every society. Japanese has got their own bugaboos at this particular time, we do too, but that was my read for sure.
Yeah, I like it.
So Blackthorn is not happy about his position. He does not want to accept his fate and is frantically trying to think of a way he could escape it, but Mariko is skeptical.
Yeah, he wants to take the boat and run, like just load everybody on it, or I guess run, but where does that get him?
Toranaga could flee like a kick dog.
Yeah.
I think that is,
he could escape with his
Mariko,
life.
He could not escape with his honor, with his, and no. that, you know, that doesn't appeal to any of these people. You know, Blackthorn, he's realizing like, oh, geez. But also, I think he's a little delusional. The things he was talking about doing would be a full day's work for a fully manned and crewed and supplied ship. Like, he's talking about repairing a mast and replacing a bowsprit and repairing a sail and getting the bilge pumps running to get all the water out. And he's talking about scraping the bottom of the boat to remove all the barnacles and seaweed. So you can actually maneuver, and he's like, oh, but you know, if Yagashiba gives me, it's like, he's, like I said, it seems like this is just a man that doesn't want to give up, but he does.
Well, showing the futility of it too, right? Like the desperate, I mean, it's not even a desperate situation. It's a doomed situation at this point. There's nothing they can do.
And we'll find out later, Shido sends some ships to kind of blockade. So it's like, even if he had gone ahead of this, it's like whether he could have stopped it or not. Because again, if you're thinking that like these European ships are immune to Japanese cannon, no. The reason the black ship got out of the harbor is because they had the Christians aboard, and every one of those guys were, what is the Christian Lord's name? Starts with a Y. But that they were all his men and they were all Christians. They all were in crosses on their neck. So they just weren't willing to open fire. They can't board from their little junks and skiffs, but they could absolutely put holes in it. So set on fire, flaming arrows. There's all kinds of things you can do to fuck up a ship that's made out of wood and tar, essentially. Wood, cordage, and tar.
Yep.
So Lord Toranaga meditates about his future while Yabushiga is confronted about him being a two-faced dick.
yeah, he's not getting out of this. He thought he could play that, he could walk this tightrope. Now he's only got one side to be on, and that side is doomed.
And his reaction is so funny, where he's just all of his reactions as things just get worse and worse. You know, here's where he sent the one-eyed general to kind of treat with Ishido. Ishido sends his head back in a box. Just his whole like, you know, it's official. And then he just laughs at how absurd his life is. Yep. What do you think of Lord Torinaga? I looked this up. So these are Torii gates that are like a Shinto thing that they mark the transition between the mundane world and a sacred space. You know, a temple, a shrine.
Okay, yeah.
And Torinaga's walking about this meditating. And I guess it's a custom that if you can toss a coin, or in this case a stone, and make it land on the top of that gate, it grants you a boon or luck.
He misses. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
But that still says that, like, a guy who thought he was hopeless wouldn't be beseeching for luck, right? Because there's no amount of luck. Is that tell us anything about his mental
possibly,
state? Or?
But a guy who has a plan might not need the luck. So
true.
It could go either way, I feel like.
After he meditates, he comes down from the shrine, and Lord Torinaga is met by his men, where he dismisses his son's enthusiasm for battle before he grants an audience with Lady Gin for one stick of incense worth of time.
Man, Nagakato just can't get it right. He's too eager here for battle. He's easily influenced. This poor kid. I just feel like he's never, it almost feels targeted at some point. Like, I don't think Nagakato's making the right calls, but the way Torinaga just always shits on him. Never. I mean, he's trying to educate him, but in a very stern and demeaning way. And that
100%
doesn't feel, well, obviously it hasn't been very effective because the kids learned nothing.
And he's young, and that's the other thing. It's like you're trying to live up to your father who won his first battle at 12. You yeah. are a late teenager at least, and you haven't got your blood. You haven't got your dick or your sword wet.
Mm-hmm.
And everything about his culture says this is the thing. Like, it's not like he came up with this, like, oh, the first man you kill is better than the first woman you bed. Like, he didn't make that philosophy up. This is shit that sure. he's heard other samurai say. And everyone talking about the glorious battles of yesteryear, and now he wants to make his mark, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing. It's like, you know, having a teenage son myself, it's like, you don't tell them one thing and they learn. Fuck no.
Oh, no.
Like,
no.
Like maybe once in a blue moon, something will align. It's like, you just have to constantly mold and shape and train and teach and tell stories and you know, the discipline when things go wrong. And to me, yeah, I think so they're showing weird, a good though. Job of him effectively molding Nagakado, like from the first scene where he's talking about falcons and how they conceal themselves.
You think this is him flying him from the fist? Because to me, it feels like he's got no control over this kid.
I think he thought maybe he had a year or two to train the falcon or finish its training, and he's run out of time. Yeah, so it's like he just wasn't finished. But I imagine another year or two that. But maybe Nagakado's just stupid. Maybe he's just sex nuts. And got the hormones pouring through him, and he's blood crazy, and he just is not. He's a Sonny and not a Michael. In Godfather terms, maybe. I just don't know that I know enough, and I was kind of surprised to see how many people were like taking glee from his death and saying that Torunaga. It sounds like you're one that says Torunaga is a bad father too. I just don't know if he had the time.
Yeah, like a bad father might be a little harsh. He's just not very effective at teaching his son. I mean, he's not like neglecting him or anything. It seems like they have a lot of interaction. It's just, boy, when he does try and give him some guidance, it comes across, and let's just say it comes across in a form that Nagakado doesn't get.
You do wonder if Torunaga had a more warm exterior heart like his brother, if like that's something mm-hmm. that Nagakado would have responded to more.
Yeah,
because he just really wants approval and love, and if Torunaga gave it a little bit more, maybe he wouldn't be so desperate to earn it, you know. He'd be a little bit more secure.
I think you're right. I think you need a little more Hiramatsu in his education and less Torunaga.
There was a lot more warmth in that first pigeon scene. I remember thinking, oh, that's true. A really cute scene of, you know, them bonding over the pigeon, and he's got a warm smile and it's all complimentary, and it just might have been like, it's time, war is on us, and we got no more time for boy lessons.
There's a lot of stuff he doesn't have time for. Blackthorn and Nagakado's bullshit, like none of that.
He does have time for Gin, although mm-hmm. He indulges her he commits to making the keeping his promise, because he was bitching about how much he was charging for Lady Kiku, and he traded, you know, a 30% prostitute discount for a stick of incense. And I sometimes Torunaga is a little hard to like. And I thought in this scene where he's so dismissive of this woman, and every time she like makes a point and looks at him, expects that he's kind of like, huh? And he looks over at the stick to kind of remind her to her times. But Lady Gin makes a big impression, because he tries to poor fist it, you know, like, oh, you know, it's, I understand a courtesan guild with protection for older ladies and a retirement plan. That sounds like a really nice dream, but who's got the time for it? And she's like, oh, you want me to believe that the great Torunaga left his back door wide open and his spy network went to sleep and he didn't see this army sneaking in on him? And like, this is the scene where she essentially, you know, this is like where she's bucking up the audience. Like, they're there. Little boy and girl, it's going to be all right. Torunaga is going to win.
Let's just say the hero doesn't always win in history. In stories, you kind of expect it, that your protagonist is going to succeed. That may not be the case here. I mean, Torunaga might be marching toward his doom, whether he has a plan or not. I am not comfortable watching any of this thinking that, oh, Torunaga is basically a lock to get out with his head.
Yeah.
Or his guts.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not, I guess I assume he wins, but I don't know. Like, win could be like in the gladiator sense.
Sure.
Where he puts down the five regents and he's got the iron fist that's going to oversee the Tycho's, you know, heir, and, you know, that he essentially sets things right on his deathbed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that his son dying has changed the calculus a little bit, because that was one of my possibilities. Well, maybe Toranaga dies, but like throughout this whole time, we've seen this son grow up and learn to side, and he's ready to kind of rob Stark it. it turns out he just robbed Stark it.
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to hear a fucking word about spoilers. Like, if you,
yeah,
like,
we're
look,
10 years
you know,
on at this point. Give us a break.
100 million people watched that show. I'm sorry you didn't get a chance in the last 10 years when we're all locked up for 18 months with nothing to do. But like the expiration on that shit is sailed. So
yeah,
pound sand, find another podcast. Yeah, I mean,
I'm not sure he has a secret plan. That's the thing. They're doing a really good job of keeping me in suspense, of keeping me in like the Blackthorn role, because I'm really not sure. Yeah, you've got again winking at the camera here, but I don't know. This could be the story of a man who is usually prepared for everything, doing his damnedest to get out of a hopeless situation and failing.
Yeah, it could, because it could be like a romantic tragedy where it's like the end of this book is Blackthorn and Mariko sailing, or maybe Blackthorn sailing alone after Mariko's whatever the lady version of Seppuku's, or, and he's just like, fuck, that was fucked. It's a fucked situation. Can't wait to write a book about it. I'm not sure either. But again, I'm assuming that like we've still got three episodes left that like he's just not going to be paraded up to Osaka and hey, I fucked up. I don't want to tear up the realm. Here's my head, Ishido.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case either.
Yeah. And again, you know, especially that last line where, you know, she's already used up twice her time because she has a story about like, you know, I came from nothing, but I was smart and I was cunning and I became the greatest lady in Izu. And, you know, you are great, but you've got the same shrewdness and cunning. And, you know, I can't imagine that the great Toranaga would let himself be boxed in. But what do I know? I'm just an old whore. And she walks off and she intrigues Toranaga, which is even better than him liking her. So
yeah,
and it definitely scores some points. We'll find out later in the episode. Yabushiga enjoys a hot bath while Omi and Nagakato ponder their fates.
Yeah, he walks right up to Saiki's guys who are right by this onsen, and he's like, "Out of my way! I'm getting in the bath."
Yeah, this just like how he just. Like, he's the only one to do it, right? The only one to cross the battle lines. And just the visible pleasure. He's like, I might not even make it another day. I'm definitely going to enjoy this bath. And just sitting back and kicking his feet up and, so good. So good.
Love it.
How can you not? I mean, okay, he boiled a guy alive. He's about to bully the shit out of Blackthorn. Other than those instances of him being a terrible human being, how can you not like this guy?
Yeah. He's so a likable villain.
Yeah,
that's what he is.
He wouldn't boil me. I'm telling you that right now. We'd hit off right away. This shit wouldn't happen. He'd be some other sucker. And boil me.
You're a barbarian. He might boil you just to see how graceful your death is.
I'd make a good stew. I got lots of flesh, well marbled, flavor. Oh my god. I would look pretty tasty. So that's the jokey joke scene. This thing with Omi is this is I think Omi is stop running game. I think Omi's like really scared and like wistful about the life he used to have. You know,
yeah, everybody is. I mean, ever since the reveal here, everything's changed.
Ever since his mom pushed him into impressing his older or his uncle, things, you know, it's like, man, I had the best lady in the land. I had a, you know, it wasn't much, but I didn't want for nothing. It was peaceful. Yeah. It was quiet. It's beautiful. And
I mean,
now I've lost everything because I reached for more.
Yeah. And that's a good lesson to learn, right? Like, appreciate what you have when you have it. Don't always be striving for more, because that's a recipe for misery. I mean, he's never been happy. He's never, and only now when he's doomed and he's moments from his death can he realize, I actually had a really good life. I bet he wishes he'd appreciated it while he was experiencing it.
Nagakato, who is maidenless and pillowless, says, nah, we're going to go out in glory. We're going to kill as many spineless punks as we can. And Saiki walks down the road in his badass white robe and overhears it and tells them that you guys are going to be slaughtered like chickens, forgotten before you even had a chance to be remembered, which is, this guy is spitting fucking nails hard.
Yeah.
And
death, and
then
he describes as a lonely path in the woods, saying essentially, like, this is not the glorious thing that you imagine it to be.
Because like Nakata's trying to hold his Bushido. It's like, okay, even if I'm fighting a doomed war and I'm going to be an unremarkable, like the physical act of my death and the death with honor and in battle, it's going to be beautiful. And he's like, mm-hmm. No, this is death. So Yabushige decides to try to teach Blackthorn how to use his katana before Bentaro almost claims his head. Yeah. I completely changed my interpretation of this scene on subsequent viewings. At first, I thought this was just Yabushige blowing off steam and bullying Blackthorn. But on subsequent watch, I noticed that Bentaro was there from the first scene looking at Blackthorn like he was a sausage that needed to be sliced. And I think Yabushige is true. I think he saw that happening and for whatever reason decided to intervene by bullying the Anjin. Do you agree with
me? I think he likes Blackthorn a little bit, right? I mean, from day one, he's always been like a little intrigued by him. I think that's the correct reading of it, especially with what he says at the end. Yeah, I saved your life. And it can come across as Yabu just being this ego-driven weirdo, right? It could come across as that. Like, if I wasn't here, he would have killed you because... whatever,
because I'm such a mighty samurai. Yeah.
Right. But I think you're right. He stepped in here, and we don't really see that at the beginning. I mean, we kind of pick up where he's starting this confrontation. We don't really see why he's doing it from the start.
Yeah.
But I want to know why Bentaro picks now to go after Blackthorn. I assume it's because he knows his sticks of time are all burning.
100%. Yeah, that's what I... That's my take.
And he'll kind of say as much in the scene here subsequently.
And I agree with you about Yabushige having a soft spot for Blackthorn, or at least finding him amusing and diverting. But like, I wonder what the relationship's going to do now, because we know that also Yabushige is fascinated by how people meet their moment of death. And Blackthorn was obviously afraid of Bentaro, knew he couldn't do anything about him. But like at the end... was like, this is what, fuck it, fuck you, get on with it.
He looked
him right in the eye, stretched his neck out and said, get on with it then. I think that can't but impress Yabushige, because that's exactly what Yabushige did.
Articulate death.
When he was down there at that cliff about to drown, he whipped out the sword and was ready to die, ready to meet his fate or take fate in his own hands. So I just wonder if there's going to be even more of a Blackthorn Yabushige bromance.
Yeah, for what it's worth,
I'm in favor of. I like that. I like that idea. I like them being best buds, being problematic faves. We have another brief but impactful scene of Fuji training in the woods with her Naginata, while Nagakato asks forgiveness for his lapse in bravery and what it cost her family.
Yeah, and he's still spouting, he learned nothing, but every one of his elders is coming to him and saying, death is not glorious, battle is not glorious, you should slow your roll here. And yet he's still saying, I can only wait to meet them, and the afterlife. He's learned nothing. I don't know. I mean, I guess, practice your weaponry here, because what else are you going to do? No fights coming.
I love, this is such a great life lesson where Fuji considers what he said and says, we do what we can when we can, and we only hope it's enough. I thought that was an amazing outlook. And I also wonder, because there seems like she's doing her own mental math, because I've often wondered, I've been trying to get in the mind of a person like Fuji and Mariko, where they want to die so bad. They talk about what a torture and pain and ignominious thing it is, yeah, to be stuck here alive, but yet just a word from their master stays their hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do they personally think if I was brave enough to disobey this Lord? Like, I don't know, like, how the honor and the suicide and the mental math works, because it's such a hard thing for me to inhabit. But I wonder, because in Fuji, yeah, and Fuji, her thought, like, the way she had a thoughtful look, I wonder if she was, like, contextualizing, like, am I being, like, a coward? You know? Like, okay, my Lord asked me to not kill myself. Okay, I can still kill myself.
Yeah, and Hiramatsu, doesn't he say essentially the same thing? Like,
yeah,
you
like,
should
why
to honor the thing that they sacrificed themselves for?
Yeah, yeah. And that's when she says the, you know, what if, you know, are we going to be victorious?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so I don't know. I just, that it's very hard for me to penetrate.
It is
that eightfold fence, because it doesn't make sense. Like, that's such a,
yeah,
a wild conformity, that be like, you want to kill yourself every day and you think about it every day, but just the word, just not being given permission is enough to keep you from doing it. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
like, that's
I
different.
Look at,
that's not suicidal the way we would talk about in a clinical sense.
No,
doesn't seem
no,
like it.
That's yeah, it's a belief driven suicidal tendency, right? It's like, I don't know. They talk about it in very real, like, pain terms, though.
Mm-hmm.
They talk,
yeah,
about it like,
drowning.
It is painful for me to live, emotionally painful. And I'd rather be dead than experience this for another hour. I can't get my head in that space fully. I understand it conceptually, but it's hard to really grasp that. I agree. Now, Mariko is a little bit of an exception, because she's got the Christianity stuff mixed in, which, you know, and as an American, we all have a tinge of that kind of in us, and we understand, yeah, it sort of instinctually. That I look at and say, well, if she does kill herself, it's not just like, I can get into the afterlife belief there, right? Because I don't know what the Japanese religious beliefs of the time are on suicide. Mm-hmm. But I do know about the Christianity ones, and they view it as something that could potentially just end your afterlife before it's begun.
That's it's a mortal sin.
Yeah, that means you're going to hell. So I think, like, Mariko's got that extra added layer, right?
Which they haven't really talked about, the tension between and I wonder if that's some kind of weird Japanese syncretism, where they don't view this type of death as a suicide. Like, a suicide is like, well, if you know, you haven't dishonored yourself and you just waste your life, but obviously if you dishonored yourself, then
or maybe the Christians are doing like the Witnesses do. They haven't quite exported that part of the religion yet. They'll tell you about, oh,
right,
yeah, and we've got this hell doctrine. Oh, and we've got, you know, this shame stuff that you should feel at all times.
Yeah, like, he's talking about we used to be Jehovah's Jehovah's Witnesses. We don't lead when we're knocking on doors.
Yeah.
By the way, if you accept this, you won't be able to take blood transfusions.
Uh-huh.
Forget about voting.
You'll have to disown your children if they ever decide that they don't want to accept
it.
Yeah,
if your kids have sex before marriage, you're going to have to disown them, kick them out of the house. Sound good? Everlasting life. But yeah, they don't lead with the worst foot.
You put your best foot forward. Yeah. I don't know if that's the case.
So Lord Toranaga engages in a little Yabushigi style will writing.
I'm sure Yabu's writing one too right now. Of course.
He's probably done five or six, you know, just can't get it right. Before Bentaro asks.
Well, I think the interesting thing is here, you know, you said earlier that Gin's request did affect him, and here's the scene where you see that it did, because he's leaving a bunch of lands to a bunch of relatives, but he's also leaving a bunch of land to Gin to try and create this utopia, this horror utopia, right? Horrortopia is what she wants to create, or I guess retired. And he seems
the horn of plenty. The corn utopia, the horn utopia. Okay, enough.
No.
Enough sex worker jokes. These are all outdated, hateful terms. Cease the misogyny.
I mean, she's using
them. Saying?
She's describing herself as this, so I feel like we have license. But yeah, it clearly affected him, right? And he sees that that's the right thing to do. These people need to be provided for when they're of no use to their society anymore.
So you think if Toranaga loses this war, do any of the lords respect any of the wishes about what he wants to do with his lands? Or do they just like parcel that up amongst themselves as they wish?
That's what I didn't understand about this. To the victor go the spoils, not to the loser's relative go the spoils. So I didn't understand why, but it could be a societal thing. I don't know.
Thought is like Torunaga thinks he might die in battle, but he's pretty convinced that his side will win the war. Because that's the only reason a will would make sense. If he was actually going to get beheaded in disgrace, I think the first thing the lords would do is take great pleasure in shredding that will and giving all of the lands up to their cronies. So like this tells me that like he might think he might die. This is a big gamble, but he must be pretty sure that he's going to win, or at least have a hope of it. Because like if he's just giving up, if that is his plan, there is zero hope. And you know, again, tell me if I'm wrong. I know we got some Japanophiles and some historians. If there was some kind of weird thing where they just had to respect the will because the whole spirits and the afterlife and Torunaga might come back as a wrathful ghost and stuff. Like there might be that, and they would take like, okay, we're not gonna. You know, have to respect at least the grandchildren part, and you know, but
that's the thing. It feels like he's running. This might be a post-mortem plan that sort of, you know, gotcha from the grave, right? For Torunaga, where they've beheaded him, they've killed him, and that's what they really want. They want Torunaga to stop consolidating his power, and if you know he spreads out his power this way to relatives after his death, well, that beast is decapitated. It's not nearly as threatening. Maybe he's hoping that they will, you know, observe the traditions, right? If he observes him, if he goes there and slices open his belly and lets him chop off his head, maybe they will say, okay, he did the right thing. Let's do the right thing. Because the threat isn't there anymore.
Oh.
But I don't know. That's risky because these guys don't seem like those types. At least Ishido doesn't and Lady Ochiba.
Oh, yeah. The Lady Ochiba is like, yeah, she's the one who would take the most delight in butchering any will.
Oh, yeah.
I looked up a cho because he carves out 2 cho of land in his Edo province for Lady Gin to do whatever she wants. I looked it up, and that's approximately 358 feet. And I'm assuming since we're talking land, that a square, which would be about 130,000 square feet. And in America,
it's an Amazon acre, warehouse.
I don't know how big an Amazon warehouse is, honestly, but an acre is about 44,000 feet. We know about what an acre. So this is about 3 acres or about half a city block. The other possibility, if he says 2 cho, if he's meaning a cho square, then just take that by half, like a quarter city block. But it sounds like a night, because she's essentially proposing a red light district
with
union benefits, you know?
Yep. Some kind of retirement plan, some kind of pension, I guess.
So after this, Buntaro comes in and he asks permission to take the barbarian's head for ogling his wife.
Yeah, and Torunaga twists it on him. He's like, he knows that he doesn't want to kill Mariko. And he says, well, if you're accusing Blackthorn, you must also be accusing your wife. And he has to say, no, I can't accuse my wife because I would have to kill her if I accused her. And so he can't kill Blackthorn either. Like he puts him in this logic trap, which I love.
I don't know if it works though, because like I don't know what Japanese law is in feudal societies, but it's almost like you're free to ogle another man's wife as long as she doesn't ogle back.
It's right.
There's a 2-to-tango provision in the Japanese common law that I don't know if it, because like half the time I can't tell if Torunaga is like in. Because obviously Torunaga knows a lot more that's going on than he's letting on, but he's playing stupid. So it's like, I don't know if he's playing stupid here too, but I was surprised by how choked with emotion Buntaro is when he's talking about like, no, he doesn't accuse his wife.
Somebody
tell if he's that emotional because he does, or
someone please kill Mariko. Please.
Yeah.
She's begging. Yeah. She's literally begging to be killed.
Like 3 different
no
times in this episode.
No, man.
She's daring Buntaro too. It's like, my life is yours to take, husband.
Yeah, Torunaga won't kill her. Yeah, it's please.
And Torunaga's
someone think
pissed.
Of Mariko.
Tornaga's pissed. He's like, I've been for four episodes hearing about this Anjin and you bullshit. Like, are you going to shit or get off the pot?
And
are
this
you
is
with
the
me
last damn thing I need on the cusp of war when we are doomed. I don't need this shit. Stop it.
And she's and she turns it into another, like, okay, you're right, Lord. I've let you down. Give me leave to kill myself. And he just, the way he smacks that knife out of her hand and goes out and almost, like, looks into heavens, like, God help me. Everyone in my camp wants to kill themselves.
Yeah.
From my son down to this lady, Blackthorn. Yeah, he feels like, and I don't, this is the thing that I don't understand, because it doesn't mesh with what I believe is happening, which is he's in control. Like, he's got some kind of hammer, anvil type scenario he's going to pull with his brother's army. He's going to co-opt his brother's army. Like, this amount
we'll
of despair.
See.
But maybe it's just a touch and go high stakes maneuver he's pulling out here. I don't know.
Yeah, it's frustrating because he can't tell them, but also they're acting like idiots and he needs them to be strong right now. Yeah.
So we are at the end of this day. It is dusk. The sun is setting, and in a surprise move, Lord Toranaga surrenders utterly to his brother's forces and submits to the will of the council. Crimson Sky is declared a mistake.
Yep. Toranaga has nowhere left to go and nothing left to be. And we hear, this is the scene where we hear the truth of his conquest when he was 12 years old, and how that went with the him being the second of this other warlord. Not so well. Took 9 strokes at least to take this guy's head off. He's hacking away at it like a Thanksgiving turkey.
Yeah, and Iron Fist says, you like, laughs and says, yeah, you made a real mess of that. I like this scene a lot, because at first he thinks Toranaga's like rebuking him for, like, hey, you know, my brother's talking about my shitty pants and you're sitting there not saying nothing. And he's like, no, I don't care about that. I'm talking about the single stroke bullshit. And the way that Toranaga ends the conversation with, like, honestly, who picks a child to be their second? Like, I don't think he feels bad, because it's like, what did you expect? I'm a 12-year-old, then I'm going to hack your body. I'm going to hack your head off your body. Like,
yeah.
If you want a quick death, you should have chosen one of the experienced samurai.
Yeah, he's for sure not choosing his own son to be his second when the time comes.
And throughout this episode, this is one of the key times, like, as he, you know, assembles his forces to meet his brother, he reflects back to him being a boy meeting this man. And I kept on thinking about the way that warlord said, I was fated to pick a battle that I could not win. Which is, there's a couple of things, like, that kind of dishonors, you know, Toranaga, right? Because he's essentially saying, you know, if things were equal, I could have beat your ass. But I was forced by honor to go to a war I couldn't win. The forces were unequal.
I think what he's saying there is he never wanted to go against Toranaga. It's nothing personal is what he's saying. I simply got caught into the flow of fate, you know, got caught up in it. And it was my turn behind the sword. And it was a battle we knew we couldn't win, but I had to go anyway.
So even we disagree, and I think you might be right on that interpretation. I think the flavor is the same, which is Toranaga is wondering if he has picked a fight that he can't win.
Yeah.
Which is something, because especially since he's been trying to avoid this since the Taiko died. Like, if he wanted to be Shogun, Taiko would have made it. And he's like, well, if you do that, I'll just be instantly cut apart. I'm not strong enough yet. And it seems like, you know, in terms of him wanting to be Shogun, he's spent the time since being strong enough that he could repel that attack. And I feel like Toranaga probably wishes he had more time. He wishes he had another couple months to get things set. Wishes the earthquake hadn't hit him for sure.
Oh, yeah. None of this is what Toranaga wanted. I don't think he really even wants a war. But here he is.
I also like how they contrasted the silence of his men entering in their full armor. And then when Saiki's forces come and it's just a thunder of the hooves and the pounding. And it's just this great host and it's just kind of setting the scale of the armies. He completely gives up. Yabushiga and Nagakato, his son, both stand up and try to protest, but Toranaga smacks it down.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me. When Nagakato stands up, Bentaro goes for his sword, And like half stands, I didn't know if he's standing there to face off against Nagakato or help him out with whatever he's about to do.
I think the latter. I think, yeah, Bataro's so? Going to jump with the in way on they
treat,
whatever.
I don't know, man, because the way they treated, I don't remember his, Tadayoshi, Fuji's husband, mm-hmm. the way that was seen, I could see this as being like an affront to his father's honor, to Nagakato's father's honor, Torunaga.
Yeah, it could be, but still, I don't know. Maybe it's my interpretation is like an almost like a instinct or reflex. Like my boys are jumping, I'm going to jump with them.
Yeah, it could be that.
And like if Torunaga doesn't want it to happen, he can say, and he obviously did.
Sure.
What do you think about Blackthorn standing up and addressing Yabushiga and Nagakato directly? I think he's kind of almost saying like, you guys are the only ones with a pair between you. The rest of you are dead men, don't have any respect for you, crimson fucking horseshit, I'm out.
Yeah, no, it's a rebuke of everything. It's a rebuke of the Japanese culture in general, right? He just doesn't, he's over it. He's been confused by it for months, years at this point. He just can't deal with it anymore on the eve of his death. And so he leaves.
And it's got to be such a waste. Like he's like the famous trickster tricking his men into a noiseless smother.
Yeah.
What a the furthest you can get from a beautiful death that is. Just like that you're just like a sack of kittens going to be thrown into the river.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
You said he had the ice cold line that you have nowhere to go. Saiki says you have nowhere to go and nothing left to be. And Nakato, you can see him. He just cannot process what's happening. He's like literally his 18-year-old brain is blue screening at what his father's doing here.
Yeah.
So that night, Saiki is attacked in the Willow World by a small force led by young Nagakato. Unfortunately, Torunaga's son denied a beautiful death.
Oh, yeah. Pretty ugly death.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you that this
very
went down
shocked.
This way?
I mean, I can't believe he couldn't cut him to ribbons inside of the building there. Like, the man is the man is naked with a thin-ass robe that's way too long, by the way. Hinders his movement. Like, he should probably just ditch the robe and go nude. But, like, he's rolling around on the floor. You're telling me you couldn't get a single strike on this guy? I guess he grazes his leg. I think I could kill just about anybody with a sword like that if they were as defenseless as that dude.
But part of it's pulling the trigger, right? The first time you kill a man?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's a moment. You're also wondering.
But
he's probably in his head thinking, is this as good as pilling with a woman? You know? And, yeah. And he thinks he's got his uncle,
I gotta
like...
I remember this feeling.
He thinks he's got his uncle cornered in the room, but his uncle just Kool-Aid mans through the wall, because, of course.
Yeah, right. We talked about this with the fire, right? There's, like, you're not in danger with a fire. You're not in danger with a man with a sword, apparently. You just run through the wall.
But I gasped. Like,
it's shocking.
This is, like, I associate this kind of stuff with George Martin, this stuff that is profoundly unsatisfying, but yet happens all the time. Like, if you read mm-hmm. any kind of thing about battles and war, just... dumb doodah fuck luck and bad luck dooms and makes so many men succeed and dooms so many others. And this the fact that Nagakata's dying, probably still aware of what's happening as his uncle's looking down and saying, where's the beauty in this? Like, god damn.
Yeah. And this is a really hard thing to do well, because this can always feel like just a cheap Deus Ex Machina type of thing, right? Where like something should happen and it doesn't just cause. And I'm always a little uncomfortable, but I think they did it really well here. They did enough thematically with this death that, yeah, it felt more right, honestly, than him getting the kill here.
I think it's interesting Saiki's emotional reaction to this. I'm gonna throw out one possibility, and it's, do you have any others? Saiki is kind of circumspect about this because he kind of liked his nephew, didn't want to see him die, knew he's doomed anyway. And just like he said at the Springs, like, yeah, I don't take any pleasure at doing this. This is just business. Like you said, this isn't personal. Yeah. It's just business. It's hard for me to do. So there's one interpretation.
Just complete.
Do you have
bullshit,
any
but yeah.
others?
No, I don't know. He just seems to have a differing philosophy.
Would it also be explained by Saiki secretly? Because I couldn't help but notice, especially on my subsequent watches, when he's talking with what's going to happen to Toranaga, he says, my men will escort your men up to the gates of Asaku.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting carve out. We're going to escort you up to the gates of Asaku. Crimson Sky's operation was to rush the gates of Asaku.
Uh-huh.
Like,
I think there's a parallel there.
It would be a pretty good coup for Toranaga to come at, you know, imprisoned by an army, led into the gates.
Yeah. Use the army as a Trojan horse, right?
Exactly. Yes, inside. Exactly. Exactly.
No, I think you're right. Jiro, I think, horse. That's a pretty juicy possibility. It's one I hadn't really considered watching this episode, taking it more on face value. But, you know, shame on me, because there always seems to be a plan. And the plan here could be to make everyone think he doesn't have a plan.
Yeah. And the thing is
brilliant.
Like, and the thing is you're like, well, why would his brother do that when he's got on the Council of Regents? I think the answer is simple. Toranaga can offer him much more than the other four regents, because the other four regents have shit that they're not going to give up. They're essentially only promise him his brother's subsection of holdings. Probably
and
not
I
even
think...
all of that, because they're going to want some of themselves. Whereas Toranaga can be like, brother, you're going to have the north half of the fucking island.
Sure.
Or shit, take the south half, I'll throw in Okinawa. You know, like, no one can make that because you know, Toranaga's going for the whole damn pie. The regents are just squabbling over to pieces.
Yeah, at best, he can have a fifth of it with those regents. Yeah, it's an interesting possibility. I think when you factor in sort of the stuff he says when the tables are about to turn, about like, what can he offer me? You know, could he offer me Ito? Could he offer me Izo rather? He's almost saying like that there isn't. Yeah, you could almost twist that into being like, well, the regents offered me this, and it's not as good as the offer that Toranaga has made here. If they already have a plan in place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because he's insulting him at the same time. It's all
this
for
all
appearances,
sells the fiction.
But
like
I know,
it's, and I wonder how they would turn that off at a switch. Like all of his men being defeated, and now it's like you got to be going into battle. So I don't know how likely I think that. I love that possibility. That possibility
it's
sounds really
cool,
badass.
Yeah.
But I think another possibility is like Lady Gin said. Toranaga's got spies everywhere. He saw this army marching. He knew his brother was amassing his hosts before. He knew he was likely to fail, so he went and sent for his armies in Edo, and he's going to hammer and anvil his brother.
Yeah,
he's
going to totally.
Have his core
that
troops that are
reasonable.
Still there, and he's going to use the train to his advantage, and his men are going to just drive them into this kill zone, which was his plan the entire time.
That seems more reasonable to me, especially with Bentaro outright mentioning it. I think it's a thing to keep your eye on because they don't make a big deal about it.
Yeah.
We'll
or
see.
Toranaga just marches meekly to Osaka. We do a lot of Zen Shinto meditations, and then he just gets his head whacked off at the end. And Mariko kills herself, and
that's
Blackthorn sails back to England.
Very much a possibility. I'm not ruling that out. Like, I might be a sweet summer child, but I think they're... This is headed toward tragedy, not our heroes being successful.
Well, that's all the thoughts I've got, Jim. What about our listeners? They got anything that they want to talk about?
Yeah, they have plenty. We've got
all
several
right.
pieces of feedback here.
Shogun@baldmove.com is how you get feedback into the podcast. Of course, we also have our social medias at Bald Move. If you'd like to know what else we're doing, we just wrapped up The Walking Dead, maybe all for all time. And we're getting ready to start Dark Matter in a bit. That's going to be our next kind of pulp thing. But we got stuff planned all summer long. House of the Dragons coming back in June. We got a great show on that. The Boys is coming back in June. We've got a really good podcast on that. And then The Bear. Speaking of prestige, speaking of Hulu prestige, I bet a lot of Shogun people watch The Bear. We're going to be talking about that when it releases in June as well. So hang tight. Don't go anywhere if you like the Shogun coverage. And if you're already subscribed to the Bald Move Prestige feed, then you'll be good to go for all for the prestige side of that. So, yeah, at Bald Move on social medias, I encourage you to follow or subscribe to our Pulp or Prestige or both feeds if you want to get all the stuff we get divided into Pulpy or Prestige. And Shogun at baldmove.com is where you send in feedback, which we're going to be considering right now. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. And now, back with more Bald Move.
All right, we start off with Joel. Let's talk about the Temple Massacre, the one that happened back in one of Mariko's flashbacks with her father and whatnot. Apparently, it's pulled directly from history, and it was a group of militant monks who didn't toe the line, as mentioned, so Lord Kuroda is killing them. That's why he's beheading these monks. The show states that this was 22 years ago, and we know present day in the show is the year 1600. I don't think the book or show addresses when the Portuguese arrived in Japan, but history has it happening around 1540 to 1550 or so. So at the same time when this incident happened, the Portuguese would have already been there and establishing trade relationships with Japan and China. Which, you know, that can take a while to get trade really swinging. Lastly,
that's what I'm saying. Like, that seems incredibly quick to be discovered in the 1550s or first contact, and you've got like this level of stranglehold and integration just 50 years later,
right?
Like, goddamn, that's the Portuguese. We're not wasting time, especially since it takes a year's trip to get
that's
there
the thing.
And back.
Things happened way slower back then, too, right?
Exactly.
Technology changed slower. The voyages were longer. All that stuff. Lastly, I think I may have mentioned in last week's email this, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. You really should check out the Netflix miniseries on the Sengoku period. It's called Age of Samurai Battle for Japan. I don't remember this being mentioned, so it says it breaks all of the events of the show is based on down in great detail, and I would wait until after Shogun's done before, as it will absolutely get spoilery.
That's the thing, man, is I really try very hard when I'm doing my research not to go past like the first level, because I got Japanese warrior women, or I want to look at the Shinto gates or something. Like, I don't want to start clicking on the links that talk about the time periods and the people that are important, because you can get your ass spoiled. So yeah, I definitely I've already decided Shogun's gonna be my summer read. I would love to watch this in the background too, because I just find myself fascinated by all of this.
And if you do want to do a little digging in a place that will be completely non-spoilery, he also sends in this little tidbit, which he's not sure is not why it's not part of the Game of Thrones like intro style sequence for this show, because it seems like a big missed opportunity. It's a map that FX has published. It's sort of interactive, not really, you can zoom in and out, of Japan at the time, and it marks all kind of the major locations from the show and shows them all relative to each other. It's a really cool and kind of vital piece of information that I think would go pretty well in the intro, and we'll post this in the show notes so you can see that link.
I saw this last week because people in our Discord and I'm always reading, especially on the Shogun stuff on a Discord, they had like, you know, this posted. I'm like, because I guess I had the wrong idea. I knew where Edo was, and then because I'd looked it up in the peninsula, like I talked about, but I had made several wrong assumptions about where everything else was in its relation. Like, Osaka's a lot. I mean, this is all in the central part of the main Japanese island. Like, nice. You know, they're a lot closer than I thought, and they outline where all the ships are and the castles and. It seems like, if you want to know where, like, everybody's troops are, it's got everybody's seals in terms of Sugiyama and Ono and Kiyama. It's a really cool map. I wish it was interactive. Yeah. Like, if you could click on things, it would tell you stuff about it.
Right.
It's, I agree. I think we could have done with a Game of Thrones-style map where they're just kind of showing where everything is in relation. Because, like, it just makes this passage of time, you know, hard to gauge.
Yep.
Okay, next email, we got RCM saying, as an observation, they appear to be giving the women to show some more overt power and autonomy that wasn't in the book. Sometimes it works well with Mariko negotiating with Fujiko about serving Blackthorn, and other times it seems a little out of character, like when Fujiko yells at Blackthorn to give her the pistols. Negotiation scene between the Mama-san and Mariko, as well as the Pillow House scene, are two of my favorites both in the book and in all three versions of Shogun. I think the Pillow House is some of the best acting for Cosmo, who I am still not sold on. I know, sacrilege. I guess if you just don't like his Bane voice, if you don't like his, but
it's a flavor. I like it.
Yeah. In the preview, that was the shaky area I was too, but like, I don't, what's that guy got to show you? It's got a stick a dagger in his belly for you to think he's Leal. I don't know.
My God, have you seen his hair lately?
No,
his hair is getting buck wild. He hasn't had a haircut this episode.
I have noticed the okay. The shitification of his hair.
Yeah, I love it. He was shaved at the beginning, and now he's
Yeah, I guess that's showing the passage of time too. Like, it's totally. Hasn't been 6 months. There's no freaking way it'd be 6 months, right? Like, he's got like what, 2 inches of hair on his head.
How long it take to grow hair? That's a good question. Different people grow at different rates, but
I feel like it's a quarter inch a month or so. Maybe we are getting close to 6 months because he's getting quite the mop top.
Yeah, he's getting bushy.
I think Bentaro, RCM continues, would have fared better with Toranaga if he'd started with something like women, am I right? But instead he went with the whining, and Toranaga had to kind of torture him. And I'm with him. Yeah. Or I'm with Jim, rather. Blackthorn interjecting himself in the Mariko's prayer was just intrusive and really bad manners. Even if Mariko hadn't mentioned that they need to keep their distance, who interrupts a prayer like that? It's just rude. Agree to disagree, my friend.
Fair.
But there you go. Someone agrees with you, Jim. How's it feel?
Yay! I love it. All right. Let's see if Steve agrees with me on anything. He says, it might have been a rhetorical question, but you wondered aloud if Lady Ochiba had mental issues, and it got me thinking. Your observations about paternity issues in antiquity, assigning blame solely to women, I think made me wonder, since her father was a bit crazy, which led to the treachery of the Akechi Jinsei patriarch, even if she didn't have a genetic predisposition to being mentally unstable, it might be possible that everyone around her, since she was spared, might treat her as if she was at some level. In that way, it wouldn't even have to be as overt as in, your dad was insane and we think you might be too, but the subtle ways she might have been spoken to or about in a society where walls are paper thin might have then shaped her as she grew. Here's a girl who, before her father died, might have been treated very carefully because there was fear. Now, post-coup, she might have been treated much, much differently, and it would be hard for her not to notice at a formative time how quickly things changed. On one hand, she might actually be crazy and think she scratched out the eyes of fate. On the other hand, she might talk that way because she thinks, hey, this is how they expect the daughter of a crazy Taiko or Shogun or Warlord to talk. Her agency was removed when her father was killed, and she's told there's only one way to get it back as a woman, so she follows the biggest example she knew growing up. She might be crazy, but if she has to act that way, there might not be much of a difference. It's an interesting distinction to make.
It's really interesting because it made me think when you're reading this about there was something where I read about like a brutal dictator who had a daughter, and she thought he was this kind, great, gentle man because she was shielded by all the things.
Scald Dukat.
Oh shit, that's another good example. Yeah. But that's not the one. Yeah. You know, it's actually from the later Expanse books I'm thinking about. Gold Dukat's a great example too. The fact that this person, because all they hear are the propaganda and the excuses and the, you know, they don't know the reality, and it can be like really hard for them to kind of like reconceptualize. So that's a really insightful point. Also, don't forget about the drugs, the repeated drugging and rapings that she went through too. So like, even if she was, you know, mentally this, mentally that, you know, the whatever those drugs they did to her. I mean, who the hell knows? We're talking medieval Japanese drugs are making your pupils the size of dinner plates. So she could have some instability there. And like you said, the dramatic difference in how she was probably treated when she was in her father's court and everything was nice and pleasant. She had her best friend versus being shoved into a litter in the dead of night where people are screaming on fire and being like, never come back. And then that's it. That is it. That can make a person unhinge. Father Martin took time out of his daily scalp shaving ritual to write in and say, "Welp, I'm struggling to see how old Toranaga-sama wriggles his way out of this jam. The main thing making me confident is the main thing making me confident he will is the faith the Willow World Madame has in him. She seems like the wisest of the wise. I'm going to bet my internet points on it involving his now mentioned other army in Edo, which is relatively large if the Madame is right about him coming with a weak garrison."
Yeah. So you think so he didn't have the bulk of his forces there at Ajiro to get destroyed
by
the...
That's what it's saying, because I'm now recontextualizing the comments, because I was, when I was thinking about the back and forth between Gin and Toranaga, I was thinking that she was talking about his, you know, if you suffered this earthquake and you knew there's an army, like, why wouldn't you have sent for your army? But she might be right that because I was just impressed by how big Toranaga's army was when he brought it, right?
And me too, yeah.
But he's also a warlord that owns one fifth of Japan. I don't know how many troops he could might have. He's been
consolidating power for years, so.
Yeah. That was my first immediate thought on finishing the episode, is this is a hammer anvil situation. His men in Anjiro are going to be the tip of the spear. He's going to have this big host come and surround and out Saika, his brother. I can't remember.
Saika.
Got out that him. And then, you know, they're just going to meet in the middle and grind them up. And then I kind of like, I don't know, brother, it'd be even cooler if they joined forces and took Osaka by storm. And also, the other thing is all of our plans we talked about, there's nothing in it for Blackthorn. And there's got to be a reason. I'm on Team Blackthorn. Like, why the fuck did you make this goofy ass an admiral if you're just going to tell him, sit on your thumb and spin the entire time? Like, what is the point of all these gifts? So... that's the one angle I quite haven't figured out. I'm actually taking a view at the map of, Sokka. We know that it's on the shore.
It'd be difficult for them to get out in front of him though, right? To do the hammer and anvil, like the pincer kind of thing. So maybe he stationed them somewhere.
Yeah, but Edo,
that's possible.
I'm looking at the map. Big. Let's say Edo is an inch from Anjiro. Osaka Castle is like 4 inches away. And if his brother's coming from the Osaka region.
I think Anjiro is in Edo. Is that?
It is, yeah. And it's closer. It's further to in Edo. It's closer to Osaka than not. But like Anjiro is in Edo. So like, I think he could get his men. He could position his men before the crew from Osaka came, as long as he had advance warning. And we know almost certainly he does.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's, like I said, I think there's a lot of ways he can wriggle out of this trap. It's just, I'm not sure which one, and I don't know how it involves Blackthorn. And also, this could be a tragedy. This could be a, I remember the first movie that I found out good guys don't always win. I was like 16 and I was seeing Braveheart. And I'm like, all right. He's there. He's there at the execution site. Oh, but there's his dudes in robes. They're on the front row. Hell yeah. They're going to Wait a sec. Okay, well, they're hanging him. They're making it look good. They're making it good. Oh.
Wait, they're stretching him.
Oh.
Hold on.
Oh. Oh, this is like old. They don't have antibiotics. You can't. No. Oh. Uh-huh. Oh. Yeah, that was my, and then I found out that good guys don't always win. So yeah, this could be one of those things. So.
Yeah, quite possible. Finally, we get to Noah, who says, I know everyone likes to compare this show to Game of Thrones, but this recent episode couldn't help but remind me of The Sopranos. Nagikado is basically Jackie Aprile Jr., both young hotheads trying to live up to their father's glory days, only to pull off failed heist stunts and with their goons, only to end up dead. How's that strike you? I haven't seen Sopranos in a long time.
Yeah, I just watched it. I'm not sure who Jackie Aprile Jr. is.
Okay.
The senior guy. Oh, okay. But I thought he was like a civilian, or maybe he did. Yeah, because that's the thing about The Sopranos is I watched it in like a binge that lasts an entire month. So it's like,
yep.
I don't have all the plot points, but I mean, I think this is Game of Thrones as fuck. This definitely gave me those red wedding vibes. But yeah, anytime a youngster flashes out to impress their father and gets their shit wrecked, it's not a bad comparison. Like, you could say that this is a little bit of a Theon Greyjoy situation where,
yeah,
you know, trying to impress him and outdo his sister, he got his favorite toy taken away, lost a couple of other appendages, got completely broke and remade as a person. Yeah, it happens a lot. But yeah, definitely a lot of that in Sopranos too. Sopranos is very Game of Thronesy, very operatic in its storytelling. Great show too. I was really amazed at how well that show holds up, and even like a lot of things they're doing, like culturally and social commentary, have just, it's like watching The Wire. It's like you'd think, oh, it's dated, it's 20 years ago, but like, nah, man, America keeps American-ing.
Yeah.
And the stuff gets to be more in the bass relief. Bass relief? Anyway, that's it of the feedback, right?
That's it.
ShogunatBaldMove.com.
We did have Nate wrote in with some much appreciated history, but goddamn, was it a Bible? I mean, it was long. I couldn't edit it down in time for the show. So
we appreciate because we get to fold that into our podcast, but appreciate that.
Yeah.
If you got any thoughts you'd like to send to us, ShogunatBaldMove.com. Boy, I am already kind of pre-grieving Shogun going away.
Three episodes.
If they don't, because I hear there's pretty much a direct sequel to this, and then there's several others that are like set in the same kind of time period telling different stories. And if they don't anthologize this and do another couple seasons, it's going to haunt me like the fact we only got one Patrick O'Brien movie, Master and Commander Far Side of the World. Like, yeah.
I think this is going
to
win
someone
awards.
Needs to adapt more Clavell books, because this has been tasty.
I like that it's on FX Hulu. FX seems to have a reputation for chasing prestige the way that, you know, HBO has had for a long time, where they don't care so much if it's massively financially successful. And I think the show is going to win some awards come time. So I'm hopeful.
Everyone's talking about it.
Season two. Yeah.
Yeah. Like watching the subreddit, I think on day one of the show, it had like 3,000 people subscribed, and it's now like 40,000.
Nice.
That's a massive amount of growth halfway through the season.
Yeah.
And it'd be a shame to build up that kind of fan base and not do anything else with it. So we'll see. I can promise we'll be back next week to see how Toranaga wriggles out of this one, as our feedback contributor said. ShogunatBaldMove.com if you got thoughts. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.